I want to thank the people that have put this symposium in Dick's honor, and I certainly want to thank Dick Axtell for accepting me into his lab and being the mentor that he is. I'm always amazed at the fact that at the tender age of 70, I'm still introduced as Dick Axtell's student. And I am proud of that. And many of my characteristics and successes are due to the fact that I have taken what Dick has taught me in mentoring and put them onto my own lab. While I was in Dick's lab, I really didn't do any work on ticks. I worked on Macrochiles, but shortly after I graduated, while I was a postdoc, two gentlemen arrived, Harry Hoogstraw and then Mohammed Rashdi, and they got me interested in ticks, and I've been working on the creatures ever since. And I'd like to share with you what we really know about the tick-host interactions. Most of this is not from my lab. When it is, I'll let you know. Now, ticks are pool feeders, and I don't have to tell this audience that, but I have to remind myself that. And they create a feeding lesion that extends way into the dermis, and they have to maintain this feeding lesion. Now, ticks alternate between sucking blood and salivating into the feeding lesion. It's not a continuous process. However, the production of saliva is a continuous process by the tick, and we'll talk about that a little later. So here's the requisite cartoon drawing of a tick and feeding lesion. It seems like John Sauer first showed this, and gosh, everybody now does it. Here are the salivary glands, and this is the salivary glands are just like a group of grapes, and each of the grape is an acinus, and there are four types of acini, three in the female and then the fourth in the male, the type one, the type two and three and four in the background. I want to show you a little bit. I'm only going to show you two electron micrographs, so don't, I won't ask you to interpret these. But here is the first one. This is a cross section through a male. Type 3 acinus, that's the acinus that produces most of the water and the saliva. The type 2 produces most of the bioactive compounds. The type 1 acini produce a hygroscopic fluid the tick puts out on its mouth parts to take up water. And that was done mostly by that work by Glenn Needham. I had some part in it, Pete Teal. And this cell on this side is a cell that produces the cement cone that cements the tick in to the host. I want you to look at this large cell here. This is the F cell, and this is the abluminal cell. Males don't spit very much. They don't have to develop it. Here's the same cell in a female. Look at the difference, and look at the amazing development of a labyrinth. Each of these openings is open to the outside, and the water then is moved across. This is the cell that the water moves through, and it's deposited into this lumen and then spit out. So what do we know about salivary gland secretion, the control? First of all, it's calcium dependent. It's dopaminergic. It is coupled to adenyl cyclase and cyclic AMP, that is the dopamine activation of this DG1 coupled receptor. And we don't know much about another cyclic nucleotide, cyclic GMP. And so my laboratory has been interested in looking at that, and my last graduate student just produced a dissertation on it. But we do know from a master student's work that dopamine stimulates cyclic GMP synthesis, and we know that nitric oxide, which is an important prerequisite for cyclic GMP, is produced in tick salivary glands. And so we tested a hypothesis that that nitric oxide activation of soluble guanylate cyclase affects the salivary gland fluid movement, and it does independent of the cyclic AMP system. What we're trying to show is that there's another system there besides the classic system. And this just describes the percent. We used changes in gland weight, which is an easy way of doing it, to show that. And we now have evidence that both cyclic AMP and cyclic GMP mediate this salivary gland fluid movement. And we showed that a GMP pathway exists in dermacentivary abulus, and that this system is calcium dependent, as is the cyclic AMP system, and that cyclic AMP itself regulates cyclic GMP, and this makes the second messenger physiologist joyful because this is crosstalk. So what kind of bioactive compounds can you find in tick saliva? And the first thing you have to understand is that ticks are not crawling syringes. They've co-evolved with their host since the Cretaceous. The saliva has a pharmacopoeia of bioactive compounds, and they're anti-hemostatic and anti-inflammatory and immunomodulatory and anti-angiogenic and anti-wound healing, and there are lots of other bioactive compounds. So let's just look at a moment for the anti-hemostatic compounds, and there are three. There are either vasodilators, antiplatelet factors, or anticoagulant factors. And the compounds that are very important in vasodilation are PGE2, which was first shown to be extensively studied by John Sauer's lab, but was first shown by Dan Sonnenschein, who did so much work on many of these important compounds. So PGE2 then abrogates the endothelin-induced vasoconstriction. And the interesting thing is that ticks have got to obtain the precursor for it, the arachidonic acid from the host, and the fact that soft ticks lack prostaglandin in their saliva. And the lipocalins, which bind histamine and serotonin, most of this work has been done by Pat Nuttall and her people at Oxford, England. Ooh. And the antiplatelet factors, apyrase, all ticks have this. The disintegrin-like peptides, I won't go down there, but my laboratory, along with another fellow at University of Memphis, Kent Gartner, has isolated and characterized a variabilin, which is attacks the G2B3A area in platelets. And the second messenger activators, the PGI2, prostacyclin, present in ticks. The whole plethora of anticoagulant factors, and I'm not going to go through them. We haven't published the dermacentivary abulus anti-tissue factor activity story, but it's there along with the others. And a whole group of anti-inflammatory compounds have been found. It attacks inflammation. Bradykinin, which is released following the activation of the intrinsic pathway, it potentiates pain. And so the saliva of scapularis deactivates bradykinin. There's a bunch of histamine-binding proteins found in Rhipicephalus appendiculatus, again by Pat Nuttall, and a serotonin-binding protein which regulates or retains rather the histamine-binding site. And an interesting thing is that appendiculatus feeds on cattle, and cattle mediate inflammation through histamine. The immatures of reticularis feed on rodents, and rodents mediate inflammation through serotonin. Now the point of this is that ticks evolve, and they've evolved along with their hosts to manage the feeding lesion. And we have a whole group of immunomodulatory compounds again. The scapularis, saliva, inhibits alternate and classic pathways of complement activation and anaphylatoxin activity, and it again deactivates bradykinin. A lot of this work, the work on immunomodulatory compounds, have been done by Stephen Weichel, first at Oklahoma State and then at UConn. And you can see I won't go through this IL-10 story, but it's really interesting because one would never suspect that a tick would have this ability, but it does. And finally, host IgG passes across the gut barrier and into the heme lymph. And a lot of ticks do this. Almost every tick we found does this, at least hard ticks. And some of this remains immunologically competent. Why it does this, we don't know. My laboratory has shown that this is done in the F cell. I showed you an image of that at the first and second slides. And there is a putative receptor, which we're trying to characterize, that evidently binds the IgG and takes it up. Again, what the physiological purpose for this is, we have yet to figure out. There are, my laboratory has been interested in working with wound healing compounds, anti-wound healing compounds rather, and we looked at a tick and said, how come the wound doesn't heal? It doesn't. It's there for 14 days. And so we began looking at the wound healing in vertebrates. It could be divided into three phases: inflammation, tissue formation, and tissue remodeling. And this little cartoon shows that the wound being here, and the story goes there. So if you have an injury, you should get a wound healing response that starts out with immune cell activation, migration of reparative cells, and then you get a bed laid down. The major cell that it comes in is a fibroblast. So we decided to use that model to study, and we first of all wanted to see, is this going to really work? So we used a simple wound healing assay where you take a cell, grow fibroblasts out to confluence, or I'm sorry, take a slide, grow the salivary gland, or the fibroblasts out to confluence, and then just make a scratch on it and pre-treat it with the saliva and see how the wound heals. And then we, once we established that, we looked at ERK. This is extracellular regulated signal kinase. Extracellular signal regulated kinase, and we looked at that as a possibility. So there is the wound closure story, and you can see that it abrogates the wound, does not do very well with salivary gland extract. We use salivary gland extract rather than saliva because saliva is rather precious in my lab. Salivary gland extract, you can get tons of that stuff. And we counted the cells because we wanted to make sure that apoptosis was not involved in this, and you can see it isn't. You also notice that this does not work very well in 24 hours, which means the tick is required to salivate continuously. Here's a blind the results from a blind well study with salivary gland extract on the left, and you can see that it stops the cells from migrating. And finally, ERK activity And you can see the saliva, which is shown on the right, is even more potent in shutting down extracellular ERK activity, rather, extracellular signal regulated kinase. This is a very important signaling mechanism. It's the mechanism that starts all fibroblast cells moving. If you shut this down, they don't move and the wound doesn't heal. This is the first paper in Carolyn Kramer's dissertation. It was just published in Experimental Parasitology. And there's the summary. So what are we going to do next? We're going to look at the effects of cellular migration on the macrophages. We'd like to know why these things, they're actually brought in. Our preliminary data shows that the saliva entices the macrophages to come into the region. We're going to look at mast cells. And the interesting finding, we have another student, my other graduate student, Nina Poole. She has shown that it stops osteosarcoma cells from invading, so it shuts down cancer cells from metastasizing, at least in the lab. And then we like to look at the direct effect on the signaling molecule and identify the active substances through either HPLC or we're trying to get an agreement with the University of Mississippi Pharmacy School. They have a high throughput screening device from NIH, and they're interested in looking and seeing what TickSpit does. So what are the other bioactive compounds? I've worked with Glenn Needham on calreticulin and Debbie Jaworski, and we're still working on that. It's secreted in the saliva, lots of it. Why? Nobody knows. There's phospholipase A2, which was worked on in John Sauer's lab, and then a whole family of IgG binding proteins. The Nature paper, which is really interesting by Nuttall, showed that the IgG binding proteins are made in the type 4 acini, and it showed that the tick, which mates, the male tick mates with the female and then reattaches, and that this reattachment is makes the female more efficacious in laying eggs. And this is a really an aberrant form of nest guarding by the male. And so, what about tick saliva and influence on the pathogen transmission? And of course, salivary activated transmission is very important. Again, this was done at Oxford, and they've shown that tenfold more uninfected appendiculitis became infected when injected with this virus in the salivary gland extract. So the saliva has some sort of a mechanism to enhance pathogen transmission. And then again, I'll go through this quickly. Why is there so much host factor diversity? Well, we can speculate. Pool feeders are more require more diversity. The longer the blood meal, the more need for diversity. And the more diverse the range of hosts, the more need for diversity. These are some of the factors that might be there. There's a lot of redundancy in this, and that's because of the host's hemostasis. So, and there's the nest guarding, which I've talked to you about. I want to thank my integrated microscopy personnel, my graduate students, the undergraduate students that worked on this, my colleagues, of course my wife, and this is my present lab. This gentleman manages the IM Center's money, and this is an undergraduate student, and there's the money lady that manages me directly, and this technician and that technician runs my lab, and these are my two graduate students. Thank you for your attention, and once again, Dick, thanks for putting up with me. I wasn't the easiest graduate student in the world, but I certainly want to thank you again. I keep telling my graduate students, you're going to look back on this time, your graduate time, is the best time in your life. They don't believe me, but They'll find out.